Welcome to the Berkman Tuesday Luncheon Series podcast. Today's speaker was Berkman Fellow and Professor of Creative Writing at Kenyon College, Lewis Hyde. Hyde's presentation is entitled Reclaiming Fair Use for Scholars and Teachers.
Educational Fair Use project in which academics try to articulate their own norms around how to use content, and in so doing, claim some rights that the law gives them, but they don't actually use very much these days. And I'm actually proposing that the Berkman Center itself do this project. And so part of the discussion is, should we do it? And if so, how and when? When John Palfrey introduced the open house last week, he said that Berkman does three different things. One is thinking about content controls on the internet and elsewhere. Another is concerning ourselves with democratic practice. Another is education. And I think that this project speaks to all of those. And by way of framing it in terms of my larger undertaking, I'm writing a book which is a sort of defense of cultural commons. And commoners used to, this is language that comes out of medieval Europe, really, but in which commoners had use rights to properties they held in common. And one of the sort of little-known use rights is demonstrated by this slide that I've taken from a book published in 1751. This is a picture of Richmond Park. Richmond Park still exists. It's the largest, I think, urban park in the world. It's in London. And around 1637, Charles I enclosed Richmond Park. He built a wall around it to make himself a deer park. And commoners didn't like this. They protested the loss of their use rights, basically the right to travel across, the rights of way, but then also you had a right to take gravel, you had the right to cut shrubs, you had the right to take water, to gather underwood and so forth. And once this is walled, you lose these rights. So there's a lot of detail around this story and around use rights, but the one that interests me is that sometimes in a commons, one had the right to throw down encroachments. So there's a sentence from a law case from the 19th century. If the Lord doth enclose any part and leave not sufficient commons, the commoners make break down the whole enclosure. So what you see here is, this is the vicar leading his parishioners in the destruction of the wall around Richmond Park. So anyway, if as some people think, the knowledge economy in the United States is suffering from a second enclosure, then claiming the full range of fair use rights might mean exercising this old common right, the right to throw down encroachments. So look, there's a lot of history. I'm going to give a little bit of history around the origins of fair use. And in back of it, of course, is the history around copyright, which, as probably you all know, the short history is that copyright used to be short and clearly limited, and now has become statistically perpetual and almost unlimited. If Amar wrote the internet address on the blackboard, that actually, he now owns the copyright to that due to our default copyright system. So there's a lot of history, but the one little piece of it that I thought I would tell you about is the classic case out of which fair use arose. And this is the middle 19th century, a case called Folsom versus Marsh. Copyright originally, at the end of the 18th century, covered only verbatim copies of books. If, for example, I wrote a novel and you made a translation of it, your translation would be considered a new work. Took effort, took ingenuity, you put time and labor into it, you get to own it. It's not a derivative of my work, at least I don't own it. I can't stop you from doing it. I can only stop you from making verbatim copies of my novel. Or if I compiled an 11-volume two-volume abridgment of it, again, I couldn't sue you for infringement because abridgments were considered new works. So all this, this is part of the extension of the range of copyright. All this begins to change in the 19th century. And a former graduate student here named Oren Bracha did a wonderful thesis called Owning Ideas, and I draw from that in this. He points out that ironically, the origination of fair use as a concept comes from this spreading range of copyright control. And as I say, the foundational court case is Folsom versus Marsh, and it was in fact a case in which one party had made an 11-volume collection of George Washington's work, and another party had made a 2-volume abridgment that took over a third of its contents from the larger set, and the publisher of the larger set sued for infringement, and he won. And the opinion in the case is written by Massachusetts Judge Joseph Story, and if you walk into Langdale Hall, you have to pass Mr. Story preserved in marble. And Story's description of the case is full of what he calls metaphysics of the law. He admits that a fair abridgment of an original work is not a piracy, but then he asks, but what constitutes a fair abridgment? And I'm not going to go into a lot of details, but this is the birth of the beginning language around fair use, and this is a quote from Justice Story's opinion. We must often, in deciding questions of this sort, look to the nature and objects of the selections made, the quantity and value of the material used, the degree to which the use may prejudice the sale or diminish the profits or supersede the objects of the original work. So there's a sort of list here of things you might look at to decide if this is a fair use. And they become the reference point for adjudication around this until 1976, when you get a list actually written into law, to which I'll turn in a minute. One nice thing that Bracha points out about this, well, two things to comment on this rather than talking about the list. And the first is that what happens in the way Story writes this is that the language around what you're trying to do with copyright shifts away from concerns with the public good, for example. As you may know, the constitutional language around copyright talks about the progress of knowledge, and the first Copyright Act, 1790, was not called a Copyright Act. It was called an Act for the Encouragement of Learning. So there was this sense that somehow the public good is supposed to be served for this. Story's judgment puts the emphasis a little bit more on commercial good. So he speaks a value in this language, and you know, value could include the public values, but it certainly does here include commercial value. He says so himself. The issue is things like the profit of the original work. So this is, you could take this as one of many inflection points in the mid-19th century where you see a kind of shift from what some people call civic republican ideals into what could be called commercial republican ideals. The second thing to say about what happens in this Folsom Marsh is that it's part of the abandonment of the idea of the verbatim copy as what's being protected. And copy begins to become a kind of an abstraction, and such that now a translation of a novel could be a copy of the novel, even though nothing in the translation looks like the original. So now, you know, now we're in a more recognizably modern world in which, to the degree that there are potential conflicts between, say, First Amendment free speech rights and the ownership of ideas, these get adjudicated not as they originally did in terms of limited monopolies in verbatim copies, but now in terms of market value and of monopolies that are less and less limited and in properties that are more and more abstract. So now, leaping 135 years, we come to the present moment. So I apologize to those of you who know this well, but it's useful to have this language in front of us. This is the Fair Use Statute, the beginning of it as it now appears out of the 1976 law. And so, you know, sections 106 and so forth lay down the exclusive rights that you give to creators. And then section 107 says, well, there are going to be some exceptions to this. notwithstanding the provisions in these earlier, fair use of a copyrighted work, including such use by reproduction in copies of phonorecords for purposes such as criticism, comment, news, reporting, teaching, including multiple copies for classroom use, scholarship or research, is not an infringement of copyright. This, by the way, is called the preamble to this piece of the law. And it should be noted that it does include language that would seem to give you hope if you were an educator trying to think about fair use. It talks directly about teaching, classrooms, scholarship, research. Sadly, the preamble is not where the meat of the law is. It's in what follows, which are called the four factors. So if a particular case comes before you, you're supposed to begin to look at it in terms of these factors. And I won't read them to you, except to note that, again, in the first one, educational purposes are again mentioned. So that in both the preamble and the statute and the factors, there seems to be some privileging of education. And it should also be noted that there's almost no case law in which an educator's claim to fair use has been adjudicated. So it's hard to tell where you can get your purchase on this stuff. As for these factors themselves, I myself find them almost impossible to remember, which I think is not so much a flaw of my memory as something about the way they're written. They're written with an intentional abstraction. And to put this positively, the worry, I think, is that if you wrote something very specific about what you could and couldn't do in fair use, you might find later that you had blocked some speech you meant to allow. So there's a positive side to the ambiguity of this statute. The other way to put this, or the other reason maybe, that we live in a world in which everything changes, technology in particular, and you don't want to write a statute in which 20 years from now you realize, again, that the ground has shifted under you and you can't apply it. So there's reasons for this vagueness. But of course, what it does as well as preserve these things we might value is to make it hard to figure out exactly what rights you can use. And so let me just do two of them in this regard. I mean, take this third factor, the amount and substantiality of the portion used. So you might get the impression from this that it's wrong to copy, say, a whole work. And maybe you should be limited to some portion of the work. Probably some of you know some guidelines around this, which I'll talk about in a second, but maybe say 10% or one chapter or something like this. But this is not the case. I mean, there are cases in which it's clear that you can copy the entire work. Is it the Betamax case? The case in which the Supreme Court says, look, you can copy an entire TV program onto your VCR and use it later. This is an entire work. You can take an entire chapter out of a book and use it in your classroom. These are allowed uses. In fact, the statute contains no language at all about the amount. No specific rule about the fair amount. There is even a 1985 Supreme Court case in which the court ruled that reproducing 7,000 words from an out-of-print book for purposes of commentary was fair use. Or take factor one, whether the use is commercial or not. If you notice, by the way, now when I put a DVD in my DVD player, they've adjusted the language around the FBI warning or the company warning, and they put in, even if it's non-commercial, you could be in violation. I think because many people assume that this is the big divide. Anyway, here you might think, well, if it's commercial, I can't do it, but that also is not the case. There are lots of commercial uses in which you can claim fair use. One concept that comes into play here is the distinction between a derivative work and a transformative work. Derivative work, such as a translation or an abridgment, you are supposed to go get permission, but transformative means you really begin to repurpose the thing, that you're using it for something else. You're using a advertisement for a magazine and a class to illustrate a point about how media works. You've moved it from one situation to another, and transformative works tend to be easier to clear under fair use. You know, if it's there to enable political educational discussion that would not otherwise be available, you can use it. And finally, this does contain the word purpose, nonprofit educational purposes, which seems perhaps to refer back to this preamble in which there's a sort of list of purposes that includes teaching and scholarship. Again, unfortunately, these are potentially non-infringing. If you actually had a case to decide, you would have to go to these four factors and begin to work through them and scrutinize the case in terms of these, not in terms of the preamble. So this brings us actually to the flip side of the statute's vagueness. On the one hand, it's vague, it's hard to figure out what you can and can't do. The flip side is, then you begin, what you'd like is for some cases that give you specificity. You know, if you could adjudicate a case and get the Supreme Court to say that you can do this, then you would know for sure what to do. And again, there are almost no cases around education that do this. But let me do the one case, or the pair of cases that people do know about in terms of what you do and don't get from specificity. And this is the question about multiple copies for classroom use. There have been two instances of litigation around student course packs, Kinko's and Michigan Document Services. And in each case, the course packs were found by the courts to be infringing, not allowed to do this without getting permission. And this would seem to show that we shouldn't make course packs. But I don't think you can make that conclusion directly from these cases. For, in fact, both of these cases involved commercial copy shops. And the commercial element in these cases was important in how they were decided. So suppose that you were a media studies professor and you wanted to put together a course pack of printed advertisements, and you annotated them showing how they worked, and you put some study questions after each one, and you took it to the university copy shop and you had it copied at cost and sold to the students at cost. Would the law allow you to do this? I don't think we know. I actually think it should, but there isn't a case that would show you for sure whether you could or could not do this. So in any event, the problem facing a scholar or a teacher who is trying to benefit from the fair use doctrine is, on the one hand, that the doctrine itself is so general as to make it hard to get a grip on it if you're trying to be conscientious. And on the second hand, the places where you can get a grip on it are so specific that it's hard to know if they fit your case or not. So then how can you bring clarity to this? Suppose you actually want to use, you want to tear down the encroachment that you feel has been made on your commons, and you want to use this. How can you get specificity? The one way that people have tried to do this is by enumerating guidelines. That is to say, to come up with rules of thumb about what you can or cannot do, so you get sort of safe harbors. And the famous example of guidelines comes out of the 1976 law. When they wrote this law, the Congress asked owners and users to sit down together and try to talk and figure out if they could agree on some guidelines. And so the owners were the publishing industry. The users tended to be the people like the American Association of University Professors. And they talked. And in the notes to the 76 law, appear the result of these talks called the classroom guidelines. And this is where you find the stuff you probably know about guidelines, things like this. single copies for teachers, you can make a chapter from a book, you can make a short story, so forth. Here's some guidelines around multiple copies for classroom use. Note that this contains some language. The copying meets the test of brevity and spontaneity as defined below, cumulative effect. So these guidelines also include some definitions. Here's brevity, a complete poem of less than 250 words. 10% of the work, or 1,000, so you get this. So this would seem to make, this would seem to be helpful. Here you have some guidelines you ought to be able to take your case and decide about. In fact, the very clarity of these guidelines obscures three problems that they have. And here there's an article by Kenneth Cruz about this in the Ohio State Law Journal that lays this out in great detail. But first of all, first problem is actually the users were excluded from the final formulation of these guidelines. If you read the notes to this 76 law, you find this very odd statement. Representatives of the AAUP and the AALS have written to the committee strongly criticizing the guidelines, particularly with respect to multiple copying, as being too restrictive with respect to classroom situations. So the committee happily produced and reproduced in the guidelines, in the notes, the guidelines that were produced by the publishing industry. They didn't reproduce these letters. I've actually found the letters. The letters sadly refer to earlier letters. It's hard to reproduce this history, but so this is the first problem, that the guidelines are not actually a negotiated settlement. And there have been several attempts to sit down at the table and get users and owners to negotiate together, and they have uniformly not worked. So the second problem with these guidelines is that actually they don't really have much standing in the law. The law is the statute. The notes to the law are, well, supposedly they're there mostly to help you clarify ambiguities, but they don't really have standing. In fact, in one of those document course pack cases, the litigants asked the court to say, look, the guidelines say no anthologies, these guys are making anthologies, clearly they're illegal. And the court said, we can't rule on the question of anthologies. If we were asked to do it, we would have to go back to the four factors. The guidelines in the notes are not the law. So you don't have legal clarity from the guidelines. You may have a safe harbor. It might be that you're not going to be sued if you're following these guidelines. But in fact, you don't know for sure, again, what you can and can't do. You'd have to go back to the four factors. And this includes, by the way, that the language that the guidelines define, this language about brevity and spontaneity and cumulative effect, none of it is in the statute. Okay. Finally, the third problem with these guidelines is that it's not clear whether they are minimums or maximums. That is, if it says you can take a chapter or 10%, is this the most you can take or is this the minimum? This shouldn't be the case, by the way, because the guidelines actually say this. The notes to the statute say that they state the minimum and not the maximum standards for educational fair use. Minimum, not maximum. However, what's happened is confusion has crept in, particularly because there was a case that ended up at New York University. What happened, this is actually earlier than the Kinko's and Michigan Document Services. In the 1980s, the publishing industry went after some copy shops, which were making course pack kind of things, and said, you can't do this, it's illegal. The copy shops settled out of court. They said, okay, we'll quit. At which point, the industry went to New York University and said, we are going to sue you. And they brought a suit naming NYU and named professors, and saying we're going to also take this to court. And NYU also settled out of court. They didn't go to court with this. And in their settlement, they agreed with the industry to incorporate the classroom guidelines from the legislative history into their own university policy. That is to say, threatened with litigation, a major research university adopted these fair use guidelines, which have no basis in law, that were formulated over the objection of the actual content users and their professional organizations. And worse than that, NYU decided and agreed to adopt the proviso from the notes about the minimum and maximum. The faculty at NYU are now asked to follow the guidelines strictly, not as a minimal safe harbor, but as a ceiling on fair use. If you want to exceed that ceiling, you have to go to the university council and get permission. So, and this then became the nationwide standard. What the industry did after they settled with NYU was to send letters to everybody saying, look, we have help for you. We now have a clear way for you to decide what's good and what's not good. And we now think that maybe around 4 out of 5 universities nationwide basically have accepted the NYU guidelines as their guidelines. So in SORT, you have a strategy from the user's end of not really negotiating guidelines, not being able to produce guidelines that are truly negotiated. Secondly, litigating cases which are near to but are not actually in the center of educational fair use. And then threatening educators with this shrunken version of the fair use statute. So this is what I mean by an encroachment on the commons. And you get the present situation, which I think in the academy, that fair use has become a little used set of rights, weakened by confusion and fear, despite the statute's clear privileging of teaching, research, and scholarship. Now, in the interest of time, I'm not going to talk much about the need to do something about this. I think it should be clear. If you want more, I brought some pamphlets. This is a pamphlet that came out from the Media Lab at Temple University about the troubles that media literacy teachers are having, doing what they want to do and trying to use the fair use statute. And of course, Terry and Bill McGovern did the Berkman White paper. And that concludes with a survey of it has a survey of obstacles to educational fair use. And it concludes by suggesting a number of points to reform, including that we might develop educator-defined best practices. And this is the final thing I want to talk about. Given the confusion around this statute and fair use, what is to be done? So one idea has been to give up on fair use. And that may be actually the correct path. And one thing I'd like to do in the discussion is to talk about which of these paths is the should be taken. One would be to give up. Another has been to try to do guidelines. I think that hasn't worked very well. The third is, this comes out really of American University, where Peter Yahtzee and others have tried to work on this, and it's to develop best practices. And what you do in this case is you take use communities, people who use content, and you try to get them to get together and articulate their own disciplinary norms around their uses. And the now famous case of this that Peter and Pat Ofterheide at American University did was the documentary filmmakers statement, and I have a stack of these too. I love it because it's so short. And I think it's also practical. A lot of what we do is idealist and theoretical. This is a practical intervention. And what they did was to go to the professional organizations who make documentary film. There are 4 or 5 of these nationally. And they got them to have their filmmakers sit down and talk about, first of all, what problems they had. And then, if they were to try to think about how to solve these problems, how they would do it. And in so doing, articulate their own statement of norms. And this pamphlet had immediate and kind of surprising success. To give you an example, it costs a lot to clear fair use rights for a documentary film. And documentarians have saved a tremendous amount of money since this pamphlet came out. One film alone, Wanderlust, the guy saved $400,000 by not getting permissions because he began to feel sure that he had a fair use right. It's also meant that a whole series of films have been released which might not have been released before, including the film This Film Is Not Yet Rated. The statement has been adopted into the business practices of a lot of public TV stations and cable companies. And also, there's a particular problem in documentary film around insurance, and the errors and omissions insurance companies have been persuaded to begin to incorporate this statement into their how they look at particular cases, making it easier to get insurance. So this is a successful project, and the one follow-on is people are now trying to do this for media literacy. So now we come to the proposal. Should we do a similar thing for scholars and teachers in higher education? And if we were, here's how it might work. the people who did this project broke the project down into steps, and I'll just describe the steps, both in terms of what they did and what we might do. First of all, this is community-based. It's a kind of community organizing. So you find the professional organizations who represent the group you're interested in. I spent a day at the MLA in New York talking to their staff about what it would mean for the Modern Language Association to get involved in a project like this. So you find the professional organizations who, in the end of the day, become, in a sense, the authoring agents of a statement. They say, this stands for our profession. Then you try to get the community together and ask them. You have to do a research phase in this, in which you find out what actually the problems are. And because they may be particular to each youth community, and your statement is going to come out of the problems. So you ask people, where are you confused about what you can do? They asked filmmakers particularly, what are you not making? What film would you like to make that you're not making because you are afraid of the permissions problem? I myself, by the way, I teach an American Lit course. I tend to do 19th century. Why? Because there's no permissions issues. And every time I do a 20th century course, there's a whole extra month in the preparations. So what are you not doing? Where are your frustrations? Where do you feel blocked and confused by the process? What uses are you not enjoying that the law would allow? What are the costs, in our case, to pedagogy, to scholarship, of the kind of misunderstanding and fear and confusion that now exists in this area? So the result of this research phase is some kind of a publication in which you just try to articulate, okay, this is the case on the ground in this community. It's helpful to do this publication because out of it you try to abstract typical cases. If you had to summarize, where are the five sort of pressure points at which trouble comes up? This becomes helpful because the second phase is then to begin to develop a statement. And what you would like to be able to do is to get small groups together of practitioners in the field and sit them down and give them these scenarios. Here's a problem. What would you do? One thing that Peter Yahtzee has done when he does this is to not tell these communities much about the law. And I began to think about this. The more I studied this law, the more I thought it was not useful to know it. Because you begin to try to judge yourself in terms of both the vagueness and the specific cases. So what you try to do, I think, in these workshops is to turn people back to their professional norms. Say, what do you think would be fair and reasonable in this case? The filmmakers made a good cohort for this project because they're both owners and users. So they could see this from both sides of the situation. And in fact, you should, in this process, say, imagine yourself as the owner of this. Do you think this would be fair? That person could also see why this is fair. But at any rate, you try to get people to articulate their own norms around this. I think I end here with the wall being broken down again. In fact, Armar, why don't we turn off the... We're going to bag the noise here. So you produce a statement that I think it's been tempting in this kind of project to try to jump over these stages, and maybe couldn't you just get one smart lawyer to sit down in the room and make a statement? The problem is, I think you need to be able at the end of the day to say, this really came out of our community. And in the unlikely or the likely event that this gets to litigation, you want to be able to show that the community has thought about this and come up with these norms, that they are considered. So you produce this statement. more or less without reference to the law from the community. Then in the process that these other guys have done, you do take it to some practitioners and say, look at this statement and just tell us, is there anything in here that you couldn't defend in terms of the actual, the way the law is currently written and adjudicated, and adjust it if it needs to be adjusted. I think if you were doing an educational fair use project, you would want to get a couple of university councils involved, have them look at this too and say, you okay with this? And if you could get them to sign off on it so that you have both an expression of community norms and some sense that it is not out of line with current legal practice, then you have your statement. And the final phase of this such a project is outreach. And in fact, I think this is almost as important and should be as fully funded as these earlier parts, because no statement is of use unless the practitioners know about it and own it, think of it as their own, and trust it and use it. And particularly you want to do outreach to the people who might stand in your way as a practitioner, to the gatekeepers. So the people who run the copy shops and the librarians and the university councils and the permission departments at the publishing houses and the academic journals and the ISPs, all of these need to get some buy-in to this, to understand where it came from and how it's been done, and try to get people to assent to its norms. So that is the skeleton of how you might do a best practices in educational fair use project. And let me close by coming back to the title of that 1790 copyright law, which was an act for the encouragement of learning. I think it's fair to say that educational fair use rights have been eroded, and that a best practices project may be a way to reclaim them, to throw down the encroachment, and to return us to that old language, and more largely to the mission of institutions of higher learning, which one hopes is the creation and the preservation and the dissemination of knowledge. So this is my presentation. Now, I actually have a little list of questions which I'm just going to tell you, but then open it up for questions. You'll know some of what's on my mind as, in terms of questions, but I'm curious just to have discussion about this. I mean, I asked one already. I mean, should a project like this be done? If it should be done, who should do it? If it should be done, how should it be focused? I think doing the whole academy is too big. How should you focus it? If you focus it, let's say you did one discipline, how could you then build it out at low minimal cost so that you begin to get the whole set of higher education? What needs to be added to a project like this? For example, you might want to have a defense fund at the end of the day. Who should fund it? I'm curious to know who here at Harvard might get interested in, or in the Cambridge community, if you were trying to do this, who might our collaborators be? So these are questions. Ethan.
Louis, it strikes me that the example of documentary filmmakers taking the lead in this is a really interesting one, because as you pointed out, this is a group that's both seeking protection of copyright law, as well as needing to figure out how to navigate the shoals of copyright law to be able to do what they do. What are the parallels within the academic community? Most academics aren't lucky enough to make a lot of their money off of publishing. It's a wash for most academics at best, and quite costly for some. Is there a branch of academe where you feel like there's a sort of similar balance of interests in play, where it might be worth sort of launching your attack in that field, because there's a sense that these are academics not simply down to tear down copyright, but people who actually understand both sides of the issue?
Let me answer briefly and then see if others have things to say. I mean, first of all, I think it is a problem with an academic fair use project. And so there are two ways to do it. One would be to try to find some node where you had this balance more structurally already. I mean, there are academics who write textbooks. I think those would be the people who really, who would bring to the table that concern, and you might try to make sure they're involved. I also think maybe, I mean, my own picture of this is that you have to be sensitive to this as you develop it, so that this would go partly to how you run your small groups, and trying to get people imaginatively to occupy the other seat. But it may be that you don't have this portion as fully present as you did in the documentary filmmakers, and that you accept that as a limitation. Two things to say. I mean, partly the way this is imagined is to avoid the true adversarial situation in which you get people to sit down whose interests really diverge at the base. And so this is not about negotiating with owners. And so you want people who can imagine the owners and plausibly are owners themselves. But the real thrust here is on the user side.
Is there any analogy, is there any counterpart to the role of book publishers in the documentary film world? Because I mean, you're right, professors are both producers and consumers and have an interest in protection and, you know, and all the rest of that. But the publishers are the ones most likely to complain. And the domain of profitable textbooks, of which there are not very many, but, you know, that's not the place where, you know, professors are most likely actually to find the fair use restrictions. Yeah. At all. I mean, most professors would agree that you shouldn't be Xeroxing, you know, 500 copies of a textbook. But it's,
you know, to my mind, another way of thinking.
So, I mean, I think what you're suggesting is absolutely fabulous. I mean, I think it's a great idea. But I'm just trying to figure out whether the success in the documentary film world really is translatable. And as you yourself asked the question, you know, where the right analogy is.
Yeah. What I think of it, actually, in the book I'm writing, I'm much influenced at one point by Michael Walzer's book about spheres of justice. And I sort of reframe it in terms of spheres of value, that there are, another way to think about this question is that, in fact, there are really distinct communities that have distinct, separated norms, and that this urge toward fairness may miss that point. And I think, again, maybe to go back to the statute singles out, and the historical language singles out education and learning as a sphere that has perhaps distinct values from these other. So I think it may be important to say that clearly and to not try to get the book publishers at the table or something, but to say these are the norms of this educational community. We're going to try to say them clearly, and then we're going to see if we can use them under the law. And the problem of how the owners feel about it is not our problem to begin with.
Could it be that the people who negotiate are the universities? I mean, it seems shocking to me, listening to this, that Harvard just says, okay, we'll require each of our students to pay $400 a year for course packs because we don't feel like defending that fair use. I mean, and no university has stepped up and said, yeah, you know, we have the resources. Yeah, we might lose a significant amount of money, but it's not like if Harvard lost that case, it would, you know, cripple Harvard. They just don't find it in their best interest to defend it. They don't see the use in it. So I wonder if part of the value might be explaining to the universities why there might be some use.
The problem, though, also is how
clause.
To bring the case, because I think you need something like this. I think something like this would be a help in bringing any such case, because you would have community standards to refer to, whereas now you don't. So.
I think the Copyright Clearance Center is also a big part of it. I've up until recently worked for years at Georgetown Law Center's at Georgetown Law Center, and I was in charge of overseeing the copyright permissions process for classroom use. And we spent tens of thousands of dollars every semester in obtaining copyright permissions, but we just used the Copyright Clearance Center, which many universities now do, and they take a lot of the profit that is not necessarily even going to publishers or to authors. For journal articles, for classroom use, it's you don't have to pay any permissions. Most law journals don't require that. But the Copyright Clearance Center charges a per use fee for every time that that's, you know, every time permission is granted, just for their service of, you know, handling the copyright permission. Whereas really all you would have to do is cite the journal. But universities find it easier just to do the whole package with the Copyright Clearance Center. And I think that they might be a large factor in, I think that the more business that they have and the more universities that sort of subscribe to them and the more money that's involved in that organization or that business, I think that they would be potentially a big factor as well in sort of trying to maintain the law as it is or to you know, make sure that permissions are required for educational use.
Yeah, I mean, this might be typical of the kind of thing you could elicit during conversations about people. You know, what has your experience been? Where are the problems and how will you begin to address them? John?
One is you might want to start in the law, because there's about 35 student law journals that have already adopted sort of open copyright principles. Let me give you a list. So that might be a place to start, because you've got a nodal. It might be a nodal community to start with, and it's a natural community for Berkman. Second is that you should probably talk to CC Learn, because this is the kind of thing CC Learn would probably want to play around with. And the third is that...
I don't know what CC Learn.
That's the branch of Creative Commons that's dealing with open educational resources and pedagogy. The third is that sort of our experience in trying to do this in the sciences is that the sciences are way too broad to do anything meaningful, so you have to break into the sub-disciplines. And you get radically different norms among disciplines of science. So physicists are incredibly different from biologists. And inside biology, cancer biologists don't like to share, but neuroscientists do. And so it's very hard to get sort of generic principles. But the best one you can get is the right to research in science. So the equivalent of this would be to have an overarching thing of the right to teach. And that's a way to situate all of the various different norms you get in the different disciplines. And if you can find a way to bring together that idea of a right to do something with the content holders, then you can do something meaningful. I mean, the human genome is open mainly because of a normative set of principles of biologists called the Bermuda Rules, combined with the journals, the commercial journals, requiring database identifiers for papers that talked about genes. So if you had if you wrote a paper about a gene, you had to have a database ID in your paper, which you could only get by submitting the gene sequence to the public database. So it was... It was a carrot and a stick that brought the human genome into the public domain, essentially. So if you can find ways to do that, those can be sort of the levers with which you can move the world. But I would really recommend thinking about the right to teach as an overarching theme for this.
John, I would actually add to that, even looking at the Bayh-Dole, the right to research kind of retained by the university on a patent that is licensed or is commercialized, that there's a principle there, that there's a value in the university retaining a right to even rescind the license, or, you know, terminate the license to the patent, because if this particular patent is not being able to be utilized in the research context. So I think that's another principle that is really important.
Well, as you know, one of the projects I'm working on here is a commons for law professors to be able to share their casebooks and their course pack materials and remix them. And so we would be very happy to be a test case, especially if you do go with the idea of working with the law. Some of the things that we probably would be interested in to make it successful for us, besides coming up with the best practices, would be something maybe along the lines of an insurance policy. We've talked with the Fair Use Project at Stanford in terms of contingencies for being able to defend us if we should get sued, whether, you know, on any legitimate basis or just merely for news, you know, basically to threaten us out of the marketplace. But it would be, you know, one of the reasons why you would buy into the Copyright Clearance Center or just avoid all of these altogether is just the risk is asymmetrical from the point of view of a professor. You don't get any remuneration for including lots of materials in your course back, and besides which you pass the cost on to your students. But you certainly could be bringing all sorts of risk to your institution. So having some kind of ability to balance, to make that risk symmetrical by having some kind of a, policy or whether it's insurance or even a litigation team ready to defend would be very reassuring, I think.
I guess I've thought of it in terms of a defense fund. I'm not sure how insurance would work. But in both cases, that would follow having produced a statement that people had some trust in.
I apologize because I came in late, and perhaps you mentioned it, but have you considered a kind of compulsory licensing style scheme, either government mandated or in one with sort of ASCAP, BMI, performance licensing? Again, it's a sort of a halfway house rather than the full thing, but it might be one that would achieve a lot of what you're after. This would be a scheme where you could use anything, you just had to pay the nickel, and so at least you didn't have to chase half the world to figure out who, what, where, and why. There are some European countries that do photocopy compulsory licensing and charge of an extra penny per photocopy.
I'm interested in such schemes. I would put them into the category, though, of giving up on fair use. I mean, I would think that this is another route. My impression is that it's not been very successful in the United States trying to gear up these alternative payment systems. I think they make perfect sense, and if it were 1790, I would love to see them in the law. But
I'm in the law for jukeboxes still. I mean, perhaps professors could at least be at the level of jukebox operators.
It's a good slogan.
As a compliment to answer your comment, Oliver, I think that anyway, if there would be some sort of compulsory licensing for educational use, guidelines would still be useful and necessary. And there are some countries with such compulsory licensing for education, and the guidelines have absolutely not been negotiated, so I could show them as an example to not be followed, if you're interested.
So, not surprising, I think it's a good idea to go down this road. I had a few thoughts about your presentation, first on the detail level, then a more general level. On the detail level, one of the things, as you suggested, was most sensible about the Peter Yazzie-led initiative was not to try to secure consensus among both documentary filmmakers and the owners of the copyrights in the works that they largely sent, instead to concentrate on the users. And I think that's the right way to go in an educational context as well. Awkwardly, one of the implications of that is that I would discourage you from trying to secure the participation and agreement of general counsel's offices. They tend to be very conservative in their interpretation of these provisions. Certainly the Harvard General Counsel's office is. So I think that trying to enlist them in the project would be the analog in this area of trying to enlist the copyright owners in the documentary film context. Now, following on that, if one concentrates primarily on users, in the sense, and there are two obviously relevant groups here, there are teachers who authorize or do in fact themselves perform the copying, and then there are the students. Their positions are not identical, that much of what's happening now by way of unauthorized, non-permissive use of materials is done at the instigation of the teachers, but then there's another way of things that the teachers don't authorize, as for example, purchasing assigned books and Xeroxing among oneself, among study groups, portions of them. Sharing film clips in media studies classes more widely than the faculty authorized. So there are two levels of non-permissive use here, and I think what one would have to pull extensively both. I'm pretty confident that what you will find is very, very widespread non-permissive use. much more extensive than the general counsel's offices, for example, acknowledge. Now, that raises some complicated questions. So, similar issue arises vis-a-vis the so-called experimental use defense in patent law, which World Bank's bumped up against, or arose when Bill McGovern was leading the white paper here, which is that you will happen upon communities that are happily, wildly in violation of the law.
Yeah.
And is it really sensible to make explicit to the world how widespread the illegality is? The argument in favor is that you can capitalize on this consensus on the ground to start to secure more formal acquiescence. The obvious corresponding danger is it'll simply trigger a clampdown. Now we opted in the media studies professor's use of DVDs, ripping them in violation of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, to make it explicit. But it was a little risky. That fortunately seems to have worked out, sort of, insofar as the librarian of Congress recently adopted a adjustment in the exceptions to the DMCA that permitted much of this conduct formerly illegal to go forward. So that was a happy outcome, but not a complete victory insofar as the constraints on what's authorized are a good deal tighter than actual practice involving limitations to film libraries and so forth. I think you would confront an even bigger version of that conundrum in this context, revealing how widespread it is in all of the universities in the United States of deviation from copyright practice might well trigger for the first time a suit against a full-blown, to this conclusion, suit against the university rather than just against the copy shop. Mm-hmm. So, do we really want to do this? I guess for reasons analogous to the film studies case study, my impulse would be, sure, no, bring it to the surface. It's what we do here at Berkman. But I just want to flag the hazard. There is this risk. Now, those are all comments on details. Now, a couple more comments triggered by interventions here on the broader issue. It would be great to secure a reform of the copyright statute to institute a compulsory licensing system, meaning a government-run compulsory licensing system, like Section 109 of the statute now, or like the jukebox exception. But it's not going to happen. That's not in the cards for the foreseeable future, for better or worse. So that leaves it as practicable ways of mitigating the impediments of copyright law to education, only three. And they're not logically compatible, but there's some tension between them. So one strategy is to persuade the owners of the copyrights to grant up front more latitude to use them for educational purposes. That's basically that's the strategy that Science Commons pursues. It's the strategy that Stuart Schieber here is pursuing in the Faculty of Arts and Sciences and soon in the law school, is to get buy-in from the producers of this stuff to make their materials available more widely, basically by bypassing the publishers, by agreeing to make open access, or at least non-commercial open access materials available on a website. All right, that's strategy number one. And there are lots of people going down this road, including a big initiative at Harvard University, in which the Berkman Center is currently participating. Second strategy is to use not government, but private action to loosen, to grease the joints of licensing. And that's what CCC does, to its credit. Now, okay, so maybe they overcharged, maybe not. They're juggling many balls here. They have, to their credit, the fact that they're nonprofit. They're not milking the system the way the publishers do. So you might try to work with CCC to, as I say, facilitate ease of licensing. That means it's not free, but it's a lot cheaper, both in the amount you have to pay and, most more importantly, in terms of transaction costs, to get access to the materials. That's strategy number two. And strategy number three is the one that you've put on the table here, namely using, again, private action, not government action, to secure an invigoration of the safe harbor of fair use, where you don't have to pay anything at all. You could try to pursue all these things simultaneously, and in fact, all three are going on, but there is some tension between them that was revealed in the fair use scholarship about, I don't know, 5 or 10 years ago, that Bell, Tom Bell, I guess, fair use versus fair use, Wendy Gordon inadvertently walked into this trap. If you conceive of and justify fair use as a vehicle to allow educational transformative activities to go forward that otherwise would be blocked, that couldn't happen, some people do, then progress in greasing the wheels of licensing is actually counterproductive. That as the ease with which one can obtain licenses through CCC increases, the argument in favor of fair use from this standpoint diminishes. So they are understood, at least from one rhetorical angle, to be in tension. So it raises a really big strategic question. If they are experienced that to that extent as being working slightly across purposes, which do we want to weight or emphasize? So having raised the issue, I just introduced one more factor in favor of your preferred tactic rather than the CCC approach, which is that someone, and why not the Berkman Center, should be in the business of defending a principle. And that principle is that education is different from most uses of copyrighted materials. It should have a privileged status in our culture and in the law. And as you nicely indicated in your presentation, it already does have in the statute a privileged position. It's just never been acknowledged as much by the courts. So if you think that's the principle we should be defending, then it argues in favor of not assimilating Harvard University to Xerox as just another licensee through CCC, but as taking a stand that all universities, not just Harvard, are different in kind and are entitled to a privilege, not just ease of licensing.
Well, this is a very helpful taxonomy of the territory. Let me say a couple things. In the draft proposal I've written, I did not put in university councils for the reason you suggest. I raised it today because some people have read it, said, oh, they should buy in. But my intuition is yours that you begin to get into this adversarial moment. As for your three practical routes, I think the future is open access, that is the main new thing to be doing. The problem is that copyright is just going to be with us for my lifetime for so long that I think you do have to work on parallel tracks. And so the kind of thing that Harvard has recently done and the kind of thing that, you know, TMP committees should be encouraged to reward open access, all that should be happening. But I think it's distinct from trying to work with the exclusive rights that people have. I'm amused by it. I did a couple of the interviews for this media literacy thing, and I hadn't thought of it the way you're doing, but it's true that there's a whole world of amateur anarchists out there who are essentially doing what we would like them to be able to do under fair use, but just kind of working under radar. And yeah, this is nice. It's useful to think some about what it means to turn the lights on in this room. Let me say one more thing, which in terms of focus around this, my own thought was, partly reading the white paper that you guys did, particularly when I read the stuff about music professors, I thought, this is hopeless. That, as John suggests, different disciplines, even in the academy, have really different practices and problems, and that trying to do the whole cohort at once is going to be a problem. Because I come out of an English department, I had thought to to begin, for example, with English departments and go to the Modern Language Association, work with them and try to do it, and then try to figure out some way to build this out at low marginal cost into other disciplines. So I do think it has to be focused in some way to begin with. Any other questions?
Just to sort of follow the Terry's point, I think that what our experience was that was by taking a stand on the principle, which is that sort of science research requires different systems. Right? You can, that's the only way to engage in the discussions with the owners. Not the CCC style owners in this case, but the university owners and the scientists, right? And in our case, it's title, not IP for the most part, that's the problem. Because it's physical control of stuff and data that tends to be the problem. But that by making the conversation be around this right that they feel that they have engaged in, and most scientists feel they have a common right to research, then you can actually start to figure out how you do the kind of things that Stuart did here or that we're doing at Science Commons. Because otherwise the differences between the disciplines just tear apart the very fragile sort of things that are common.
Well, thank you.